listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
And we're live. Not really, though. This is actually recorded a day after the interview you're about to hear. But I don't know. It just sounds cool when you say you're live. I feel like you're supposed to say that whenever you record like a radio type show, podcast type show. It just sounds more professional. So we're not actually live, and it's not we. It's actually just me sitting here in a dark room at my podcasting, my lovely podcasting table. Dr. Christopher Ryan was nice enough to join the program. He is the author of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Anyways, check out the book. It's a great book. I don't know. If you can't read it, pick it up on Audible, because that's what I've been doing for pretty much every book I read. And I don't even know if I can. I feel funny when we're chatting about books and I said, oh yeah, I read that. When I didn't really read it, I had someone read it to me. It's a bizarre thing because more and more people are doing that. And I mean, technically that information from the book got into your brain. So I think you can rack it up to things you've read. I don't know how that works out, but, I've read it sort of. Actually, I had someone read it to me as I drove back and forth to work. Anyways, check out the book. It's really cool. He's also the creator and host of Tangentially Speaking. His website is Chris Ryan, PhD. That's ChrisRyanPhD.com. And you'll find his episodes of his podcast on there. There's also links to his books and media and all that cool stuff. Anyways, he was he's a great person to have on, and I think you're really going to enjoy this show. He blew my mind quite a bit, as does his podcast and his book. So I hope you listen, and I hope you enjoy. A couple things. I don't know if I'm going to be doing the weekly show anymore. If you don't do a podcast, a weekly show doesn't sound, you know, like much. You plug in and you talk for an hour once a week and then you press publish. But that's not really it, because especially when you have multiple people involved in a podcast, everybody's schedules have to line up. And if you're booking guests, and if you're an independent podcast like myself, you're doing all the booking, you're doing all the editing, you're doing all the scheduling. And, you know, like Dr. Ryan here is out in the West Coast. So I had to kind of link up my schedule with his schedule, and Savannah couldn't be here, and Mike definitely couldn't be here. So it's a tricky thing to do. So with that said, and I guess the other option too is when you know, your schedules are kind of crazy like that, you can just do a solo show. And I've done a couple of those. Technically, this is right now because I'm talking alone in this room, but it's really hard. It's not as easy as it sounds. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. At this point, schedule-wise, it's going to be every other week. But, you know, there might be some bonus shows here and there, because I love podcasting. And if I have the time, I'm going to sit here and talk out my ass for you guys to listen to. And then obviously have Savannah on, because Savannah loves to talk about technology and all that cool stuff. So I know we'll have her on. Other news. Check out my website, waitwhatif.com. Please go there. That's where I have all my links, and that's where my advertisers, or what do you call them, sponsors are. If you are looking to get advertisers on your own podcast and you're independent and it's kind of hard to figure out how to get people to entrust you with their stuff, I guess, go to my website, waitwhatif.com/market. And I put a link on there for a company called Share a Sale. And basically they do affiliate marketing. And what that means is there's small businesses out there that want to expand their audience or their customers, and you have an audience. And what you do is you kind of just make a little agreement that, you know, you will link their stuff through your website, or like I'm doing now, you can advertise through your podcast and then give them a way to get to it through either your website or your podcast page. And it generates some revenue for you. So if, you know, podcasters have a pool of listeners and businesses have a product, and if you connect them, then bingo, there's the thing. So you only get paid when someone makes a purchase and stuff. But I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great way to expand your podcast, get some revenue coming in, and yeah, I guess that's it. So check it out. It's waitwhatif.com/market. Go there, and it'll take you to Share a Sale. Without further ado, Dr. Christopher Ryan.
All right.
That's actually a fantastic idea. I wish I brewed up a coffee.
Well, I've got this machine. You just push a button, you know?
It's fantastic. Wait, is it a Keurig or is it like a espresso machine?
I went full on Nespresso.
Yeah, I got one of those. Is it the with the little metal tab things you put in there?
Yeah, little capsules.
Yeah. It's really, it takes away the art, I guess, if there's an art form in coffee, but yeah.
Yeah. I was doing this shit where I'd boil the water. I mm-hmm. had a burr grinder and the French press. So to make like one cup of coffee, I'm washing out four different things and it's a big pain in the ass. And, I'm heating up all this water. And so this is how I justify it to myself. Right?
I do the same thing. I mean, I have, if you looked at my stovetop, I have it almost looks like I'm cooking up meth. I actually have beakers and stuff that I use for making coffee. and if I can make it strong enough, it might even seem like meth drinking it. But yeah, there's a time and place for everything. And I, next to that, I have my Keurig and then I have my, I forget what it's called. What is it? Is it Nespresso machine? Nespresso?
Nespresso. Yeah.
Nespresso. Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. First off, thank you for coming on the show. I really enjoy having fellow podcasters on the show because I don't know if you run into this through your shows, but I'm a one man program, so I look and I have to do all my booking and find people myself, and I'll get a lot of people with interesting stories, but they've never been in front of a microphone and they've never really talked about it. You know, they might be a blogger or they might be a scientist or an author, and then you stick a microphone in front of them and it's like crickets. And and when you're an audio person, or when you talk, you know, when that's your medium, it becomes very nerve-wracking. do you agree? Like if you ask a question and they you don't know if they're ruminating on the question or if you should continue to talk and try to draw it out of them.
The way my podcast is structured, it's very conversational, so. Yeah. I don't really worry about it. And one of the things I've learned over time, I think somebody, maybe Neil Strauss told me this. I don't remember. Someone who does a lot of interviews. They said that to resist that impulse that you're describing there, to fill silence.
Right.
Because now, of course, Neil's done most of his interviews as a journalist or, you know, a written journalist. So silence doesn't matter. But, you know, it's awkward even if there isn't a microphone, if you're just in conversation with someone and, you know, there's a silence on their end where you're waiting for them. But his point was, don't like save them. Let them come out of the silence, because that's often where you'll get the most interesting comment, because the silence is a resistance, right? And they're an internal resistance in them, and you know, the delay is them sort of fighting through that resistance to come up to the surface and report something to you. So if you save them, often you'll lose some of the most interesting material. Of course, on a podcast, that's, you know, it's actually, Neil and I just did a podcast recently. We were talking about books and he handed me this book and he was looking at a book. And he's like, oh, you got to look at the second paragraph on that page. And oh my God. And then we just sat there for about 60 seconds in silence reading these books, right?
On the podcast?
Yeah. Fantastic. And then later I was editing it, you know, or just sort of listening before I posted. I rarely edit anything. And I saw on the, you know, in the audio display in the editing software, there was this big gap. And I thought, oh, what happened there? Like, the mic must have cut out. What is that? And I went back and listened to it. And it was literally, I think, probably over 30 seconds of absolute silence. And then we start laughing because we both remembered we were on a podcast, you know?
Yeah.
That's, and I decided to leave it just to, because it sort of shows how powerful you know, both of us are very absorbed into what we're reading, and we just sort of forget where we are. It's great.
Helps tell the story too. You know,
I mean, yeah, I think so.
It is. It's its own medium, and it's a cool medium because, you know, 10 years ago, even like, I mean, I guess 5 years ago, they were around, but not many people knew about them, and it basically opened up this worldwide conversation that folks weren't having. I mean, they may have been having it on message boards. But to sit down and to dialogue, I mean, I've had interviews with folks in Japan, with folks in France, Canada, I mean, all over the place. Mm. And it's just a fascinating technological place. And the other thing that's cool about it is, you know, if I'm out and about, I can record on a laptop, which I am right now, I can record on, you know, an iPhone, and you get the same quality, and you're talking to the world like on a piece of plastic. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is.
I thought what was funny too is two things. One, on your email you said that you say yes to about 99. I'm sorry, 1 out of 100.
Yeah, I say no to 99.
yeah. And as a podcaster, I'm used to getting said no to 99 out of 100 times. So I appreciate that one time.
No worries. Yeah, no, I feel bad because a lot of people, I don't know how long you've been doing your podcast, but I get a lot of invitations from people who are starting out and can use a signal boost. And I wish I could do it all the time, but then I do nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good to be
here. And I'm already having trouble finishing my own shit. As it is.
I was just thinking about that today. I don't know how I have time to do all my stuff, but I somehow do. You know, if you just make the time. I'm a director of a health clinic. I got 2 kids, a house, a podcast, I write on a blog. I mean, but somehow, you know, people wonder, you know, where do you get the time to do these things, to work out, to stay healthy? And I don't know, you just sort of find the time. It's bizarre.
Or you don't. I mean, I don't work out. I don't have a family. I don't have a job, and I'm still fucking out of time.
It's funny.
I can't get anything done. Yeah, I don't know how people like you do stuff. It's crazy because you know it's like that thing. The work expands to occupy the time available.
Right.
You know.
Right.
It's like gas, and so I think. That's the problem. I've got a lot of free time. And so every project I pick up ends up just expanding and filling the time. So I don't know. Or maybe I just spend a lot more time fucking around looking at Twitter than I think I do.
Yeah, that's the sole reason why I don't get sleep at night. So I heard you first on Joe Rogan. And for the listeners, Dr. Ryan co-authored Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Co-written with your wife, and I'm going to butcher her name. Is it Casilda?
Yeah, you got it.
All right, Casilda, well, and then her last name,
Jetta.
Jetta. Okay, I thought it was Jetha, but Jetta. Okay. But anyways, I first heard you on Joe Rogan, and then of course Duncan Trussell, and then I picked up on your own podcast there. But I think of you as the hammock guy because just recently you said something that really resonated with me and kind of. I guess piggybacks on what we were just talking about. Is you're the type of guy that could wake up in the morning and go straight to the hammock.
Yeah.
And I,
yeah. Well, that was it. I was having the same conversation with Rogan about how he gets so much done. I mean, that guy is living 5 lives. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And, he's on a different planet.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm just sort of stressing a little bit, trying to keep up with one. And and that's when I said that, like, yeah, you know, because he's got that energy, you know, he needs to be doing something. He needs to be accomplishing things. And if, you know, he's in the last, since I've known him maybe 3 or 4 years or something, he's gone on this meat thing. So he decided he was going to, like, all the meat that he eats and feeds his family, he was going to kill himself. So, you know, he just decided that. And then in the following 3 or 4 years, he became an excellent marksman with a bow and arrow. The first,
yeah, which has got to be the hardest thing to do, right?
Yeah, now he's like super into the archery. He's a really good cook. He's obviously a super successful podcaster. He does the UFC commentary. He's a very active stand-up comic. He's like on stage three or four times a week out here. It's incredible. The guy, I mean, and he's a father. He's a husband. I imagine he's a terrible husband and father. Gotta be.
It's not hard. It's not really hard. You just have to, I don't know, throw the kids around a little bit. As the dad, that's your job, right? Your job is to wrestle. And think of it very animalistically. I try to teach them how to survive in the wild. And then the mom is the nurturer. So that part's actually kind of easy. You just show them a little love. And
But I'm like, I don't need that. I don't have that need to be doing something all the time. In fact, I think there's a lot of sort of undervalued functionality to fallow time, you know, to mm-hmm. just, I think one of the things that young people now are missing is silence. There's no silence in life now, you know, everything's filled. If you're sitting somewhere, you know, either you're stuck in traffic, you pull up the phone and, oh, I'll check the email and I'll look at the Twitter and I'll do, there's always something to fill every space.
That's right.
And, you know, any painter, any musician, any artist of any sort will tell you, as you know, we were talking about earlier, silence can be a really powerful, positive element. And yet today it's looked at as something that's purely negative. It's something that needs to be filled. I think lives need silence. They need empty spaces because, you know, then we ourselves can sort of expand to fill that space. And if you never have that space, you know, some writer, I don't remember who it was, but said that all man's problems come down to our inability to sit alone in a room in silence. You know, if we could just do that, if we could just sit in a room, not reading anything, not looking at anything, just sit there for an hour, we'd be better off.
It's funny how you bring that up because I did a couple combat tours in Iraq, and when I came back, part of the decompression, I guess, they had us do was meditating. I haven't done it in years, but I used to, you know, I guess spend an hour, I'd go into my back room and just sit and meditate. And at first it's so difficult. I don't know if you're into meditating at all. It's not an easy thing to do. But as you get better at it, I gained so much from it. You know, afterwards it almost was like a buzz, you know, your body kind of had this, almost like post glow to it, and you felt relaxed and you felt connected. And you're right. I think a lack of that, and I'm thinking of my own life here, if there's any time I actually spend in quiet, but I do lack that. I do miss that.
Yeah, it's important. You know, I don't know if you've ever done sensory deprivation.
I haven't. I'd like to, but I'm in North Carolina. There's really none of that around here.
Well, if you get a chance, if you're, you know, in a city that's got them, it's something Rogan turned me on to, in fact. And I was living in Portland, and there was a place up there that they hooked me up with some discount floats because it can get pretty pricey. It's like, I think 60, 70 bucks is sort of a normal price. So, you know, if you're doing it regularly, it can add up. But anyway, I had a chance to do it. I did probably 20, 25 floats or something. And for me, you know, I've done a fair bit of meditating. I did a 10-day Vipassana retreat, you know, in 10 days of silence, that whole thing.
Wow.
But it's, for me, meditation has been difficult because of the bodily thing. Like my knees hurt, my hips hurt, my back hurts, I'm slumping, I try to sit up straight and then I'm slumping again. And so it's like this constant physiological distraction. And when I got in the tanks, that was the first time I felt myself sort of slip into that meditative headspace without any bodily distraction. It was fantastic. It was really revelatory for me because, you know, I realized then that a lot of the resistance that I had to meditation and to finding that space, it wasn't really my head. It wasn't what the Buddhists call the drunken monkey and, you know, the voices that, you know, I got to do this later and got to do that.
Right.
That sort of slipped away pretty quickly once my body wasn't constantly, you know, pulling me back. And it's really interesting. I mean, you sort of, at least in my case, I got into this space where I wasn't asleep, but I wasn't awake either. I was just floating, because your body totally disappears.
It was just your pure consciousness then.
Just consciousness, yeah. and undirected consciousness. So okay. It wasn't consciousness, you know, thinking about what I have to do or did before or whatever. It's just like awareness, but awareness of nothing. It's hard to describe. And the only way I sort of recognized it was that I would wake up from it, mm-hmm. but realize that I hadn't been asleep.
Okay.
So like there was a coming back to normal consciousness, but I wasn't asleep. I wasn't gone. I was just somewhere else. It's really an interesting state. And I think for me anyway, it's the state that I had been trying to reach through meditation for years.
I have a friend, he's up the road. He's a bar owner, former Marine, big beard, Harley driving guy. And he meditates, but he does it for relaxation and whatever. And he was over and he said, just out of like a side note, he said, yeah, I was meditating the other day and I felt like I slipped out of my body and I was in outer space for a while and I was floating. And it was just to him, it was just, you know, it just happened. And I was with a friend of mine. We often talk about, ayahuasca and the ability to, or, you know, the ability to remove your consciousness from your physical body. And our jaws dropped because, you know, this is something that people try to attain their whole lives. And unwittingly, he slipped into it and described what was almost like an astral projection, you know, almost as if his consciousness was tethered to him, but he was somewhere else. He didn't know how much time he was there. And when he came back, he felt fantastic.
Yeah, well, see, I think that's a natural part of life. I think, you know, again, that's something that we lose touch of because there's so little silence in our lives. But I think that for, non-technological people who live with a lot of silence in their lives, I think that kind of thing probably happens a lot. And the more comfortable you are with it, the more readily that kind of experience can emerge.
Are we in a time of... Because you're a psychologist, correct?
Yeah.
I would, just from reading your books and listening to your talks, though, it seems like you have a lot of evolutionary psychology, if that's even a term, or sociology, anthropology. I mean, just from your book, there's a lot of anthropology and sociology in it. Do you think that this technology, all this stuff that's coming in, lack of silence, do you think it's having a negative aspect on our social spheres? Do you think it's changing our social spheres too rapidly? Meaning, you know, look at a tribe that lived 5,000 years ago. And, you know, you can find some tribes today that still have a lot of those basic fundamentals. And then you look at, or actually look at our, if you want to call, you know, our little communities tribes, and you look at them 50 years ago to now, or the last 50 years, things have changed so rapidly. It's almost like we're just evolving too quickly. I don't know. It's just been a thought of mine, that wondering what are the negative implications of this rapid transformation into a society we don't really know much about.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk for days about that. That's the focus of my research and what I'm writing now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The book I'm writing now is called Civilized to Death, and it's about how civilization is impacting the animal that we evolved to be, the mismatch between this social environment, technological environment we've created, and the animal that we are. So that's very, you're right. I think I agree with you 100%. Do you know who Louis C.K. is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You ever see the bit he does where he's on the airplane and there's Wi-Fi and he's like, oh, wow, I didn't know there was Wi-Fi. This is amazing. And Wi-Fi and airplanes, what are they come up with next? And he's checking his email, and then something goes wrong, and the stewardess says, sorry, we have to reset the Wi-Fi. It'll be 5 minutes. And the guy next to him leans over and says, this is bullshit. and then he like gets into this whole thing about how, you know, every new technological innovation, we immediately adapt to it and accept it as the new normal. And then when it doesn't work, we get all pissed off.
We really do.
And, you know, it's like, you know, my, you know, trying to text my friend and it's not going through. And what's going on? And then he's like, give it a minute. It has to go to space. You know, it's like,
I'm going to have to check that one
really
out.
Really good bit. Oh yeah. Check it out. It went viral and it's on YouTube and everything. But the end of it, he says, these days, everything's amazing, but nobody's happy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Right. And I think the problem with civilization is that this technological development that's going on is sold to us as if it's for us, right? The future is always going to be better. We're almost there. It's always going to be great. You're going to have so much free time. I remember when, you know, this whole computer thing started, like, you know, personal computing in the 80s, 90s. It was all about how we were going to have so much free time. Oh, you're going to be amazed how much free time you're going to have because these computers are going to do everything. It's going to be so great and so easy and yeah, nah, 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 nah. You know, same bullshit with they sold to people in the 50s and 60s with, oh, now you got, oh, look at this oven and you got this, oh, the super efficient stove and then you've got the toaster ovens and the microwaves and you're going to have so much free time. Well, who's got the fucking free time? Where
yeah.
is it?
Yeah, you're
you
right.
You know, I mean, I have some, but that's because, as I said, I don't have a family and all that. But a normal, sort of normal people have less free time than ever. So it's constantly being sold to us as, you know, this is going to make your life so much better. But if you step back and take a serious look at quality of life, whether you're looking at health or free time or satisfaction or relationships or sexuality or nutrition or exercise levels, whatever it is, it's very hard to argue that things have been getting better for 10,000 years. Things have gotten better for some people in the last 100 years, mm-hmm. but if you're looking at a global average of quality of life, civilization is not clearly better than pre-civilization. In fact, in many ways, it's worse. People yeah. hearing that are going to be scoffing and saying, that's crazy. We've doubled the human lifespan. You know, we used to die from polio and we used to die from smallpox and blah, blah, blah. But if you look into any one of those claims, which I do in this book, you find that actually that's propaganda. That's not scientifically valid. We haven't doubled the human lifespan. We most of the things that have killed people, the biggest killers of people, influenza, chickenpox, and you work in medicine, you probably know all this. Those things came from domesticated animals. They didn't exist until agriculture.
Hmm. Yeah,
so when you look at these tribal people, they didn't have cows, they didn't have chickens, they didn't have pigs. All these viruses jumped over from domesticated animals. So, yeah, and anyway, so the sort of a global argument that quality of life has gotten better because of civilization, that's a very difficult argument to make in a serious way.
Yeah, just look at the Korean Peninsula right now and, and try to defend civilization.
Well, yeah, and that's another issue is like sustainability.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, even if you conclude that it is life is better, you know, for the average person now than 10,000 years ago, well, okay, but the Aboriginal people we know now that they've been in Australia for 50,000 years. Are we going to last 50,000 years? Fuck no.
Yeah, the current rate.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they think there's folks that are talking. And it's funny how you mentioned that because I had another guy on, Callum Chase, another author of AI. And if I could think of his book right now, I can't some other day. But he was mentioning that in the next 20 years, 30 years, when artificial intelligence comes back on or comes online, that people are going to have too much free time. You know, that most of the jobs are going to be taken and there'll be no income and no, and the first time I had really thought about it is how you just brought it up right now. I wonder if that's going to be the case.
I think, his argument and you know, a lot of people are making this argument now with AI and robotics, you know, productivity keeps getting increased per worker because of these, technological assistances and all that. I think he's probably right about that. The problem is that the way our economic system is set up, it's not that you're going to have free time. It's that you're going to be useless.
Right.
And you're going to be living in poverty, which is what's already happening in this country, right? I'm sure you see it in your clinic. The heroin problem, the opiates, you know, the whether pharmaceutical or non-pharmaceutical, the meaninglessness of modern life, the, you know, used to 30 years ago, high school education, you could support a family. You get a job down at the factory and, you know, have a decent, be in the union, have a decent pension. That's all gone. Why is it gone? Partly globalization, partly robotics, partly AI that's already coming in. So I think it's true that the productivity is increasing to the point where there are far fewer actual man hours are necessary to sustain all this. But I don't see any evidence that, you know, we're going to say, okay, let's take all that money and spread it out and give everyone a guaranteed minimal income so that everyone can have a happy life and enjoy all that free time.
Yeah,
instead, what we're doing is saying, well, you're useless, you know, no healthcare for you, no money for you, fuck off, go live in your car. And here's a gun, you know, that's America.
Wow. It seems like technology, every technological advancement that comes out is like the magic pill. And then the repercussions are all those side effects that you hear at the end of the commercial.
Yeah, or that you don't hear, right? Because they say it so fast you can't understand what they're saying.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, that's to me, that's sort of an image of civilization. It's like, this is going to be great, and here's a picture of happy people playing on the beach, and you're going to be so happy. Might kill you, might make you miserable, might destroy your life, might kill your neighbors, and might, you know, definitely going to poison the river. Yeah. I don't know. I don't mean to bring down your listeners, but from my perspective, civilization's been a giant mistake. The biggest mistake any species has ever made, probably.
Well, I'm going to go jump off a bridge.
The good news is.
Yeah. So I'm going to go jump off a bridge.
Yeah. No, the good news is we get podcasts.
That's right.
So I think, seriously, though, to get back to your earlier point, I feel like we're at this amazing moment where, as a species, we've come to a point where, you know, we've gone down this path and we've sort of developed these incredible technologies that are way beyond our sort of philosophical and spiritual development, right? Like Einstein said something about that. I forget his exact quote, but it was, you know, that our ability to destroy the earth is, you know, far outpaced our understanding of life. And that's extremely dangerous, obviously. But because of things like podcasts, we're at this moment where there's a global brain. There's like a, you know, an idea can spread in a day all over the planet. It's incredible. And so my hope is that not just podcasts, but, you know, digital communication, that as we have, we're increasingly wired into each other, good ideas can take hold and spread really quickly. Would have taken revolutions and, you know, decades in the past, now can happen in a weekend. So maybe there's a chance that, you know, the people around the world are going to say, what the fuck are we doing? We don't need to be doing this. You know, we can take control of this. Because right now I feel like we're on a self-driving bus that's headed for a cliff. And there must be a way to override the self-driving aspect. There must be a way that we can take control and, you know, steer this thing away from disaster.
I think that's a fantastic point. I wanted to just bring it back to the thanking you for normalizing the hammock. Because what I forgot to mention on that at the very beginning was that I too can wake up and then take a nap on the couch. and it drives my wife nuts because my wife is a very, you know, she goes to bed at 9:30, she gets up at 6:30. Breakfast is from the, you know, and I just sort of play it by ear, you know. I sleep when I'm tired and I work when I'm not. my secretary will actually come in between patients and she'll hear me go because I've just leaned back on my chair. I don't know if it has something to do with turning 40 or if it's just, I think it's personally, I think it's the more righteous and better way to live, but
Well, if you can get away with it, I mean,
that's right.
How many kids do you have?
I have two. I have two very small children.
Well, so your wife is probably like running around dealing with a lot of stuff.
She absolutely is. She absolutely is.
And they have to get to school and they have to, you know, they're plugged into this whole thing that she can't just ignore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great luxury to be able to live according to your own rhythms, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I sort of joke about how, like, I don't have a job, but I figure I'm probably 60 grand ahead of the game even without working just because you'd have to pay me probably 15 or 20 grand to shave every day. You have to pay me 20 grand to just get up with an alarm. Another 20 grand to wear a fucking tie and uncomfortable shoes. So just doing nothing, I figure I'm like 60 grand ahead of the game.
That's fantastic. Another thing I wanted to bring up too, which I thought was, you were talking about how we've gotten used to technology. Have you ever lost your power or your internet connection? And what's the first thing you do? You try to turn on the light and it doesn't go on. So you try to turn on another light because you can't see because that light's not on. Or you're checking your phone and you go to, you know, do an email and you can't because you don't have internet connection. And or your phone's not turning on, so you turn on the light to go to see if your phone's there and the light doesn't work. It's hard to break out of that, I guess, comfortable cocoon we've put ourselves into.
And yeah, but, you know, it's a cocoon, but it's also a cage. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of my younger years with a backpack traveling around the world, living in a tent. I lived in a tent for 2 years in Alaska mostly. And, you know, there's a great freedom in simplicity and like being able to do whatever you need to do to be comfortable mm-hmm. and not needing that. So when the power goes out for me, it's always disappointing when it comes back on.
Oh, wow.
You know, you get the candles, and I've got, you know, I live in earthquake country, so I've got plenty of water and canned food and stuff, you know, in case of disaster. But I love that. I mean, right now as we're speaking, there's a giant snowstorm hitting the Northeast.
Yeah.
Where I used to live in Pennsylvania, they're expecting like 2 feet of snow. All the schools are closed. I love that. Snow days, oh, that's the best.
I grew up in New Hampshire, so yeah, I know those days.
yeah. I really enjoy that when the system breaks down. And, you know, there's a book called Paradise Built in Hell mm-hmm. by Rebecca Solnit. It's a study of disaster sociology. So it's how do people behave in disasters? And according to the sort of conventional view, which goes back to Thomas Hobbes, who said life before the state was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, right? The quote everybody knows, nasty, brutish, and short, mm-hmm. Which is the sort of baseline assumption of why civilization is so good. Because before civilization, man was a wolf to man. We, you know, we're brutal, we're horrible, we're basically chimpanzees with this thin veneer of civilization that stops us from killing each other, being and pillaging and all that. Anyway, you would think that when society or sort of social control breaks down because of disasters, that's when this horrible aspect of humanity would emerge. And what she shows in this book is that that's exactly the opposite of what happens. What happens is when shit hits the fan, that's when people get really generous and kind to each other. That's when the best emerges from people, not the worst. And in fact, she quotes the guy who sort of founded that academic discipline at the end of his career. He said, you know, I've been for 50 years, I've been studying how people behave in disasters. And I've come to realize that the real disaster is daily life, normal life. Because that's when people feel isolated, alone. But when a disaster hits, that's when they've got community, they've got meaning, you know, there's all this sort of connection. And they look back on it those who survive, of course,
yeah,
they look back on it as the best time in their lives.
I was just talking to my father-in-law about this, how it's this weird, there's good, it's the yin and the yang, right? This generation hasn't really had adversity. They haven't had bread lines, or they haven't had horrible wars, and including mine. I mean, I'm the tail end of Gen X. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing that we haven't had polio or flu outbreaks. But in the same sense, with a lack of adversity, you kind of lose something. You lose a touch of your humanity. I don't know where I would be had I not been to a combat zone. You know, had my life not come, you know, millimeters from death, it was only then that I actually appreciated life. I mean, I worked as a stockbroker in Boston for my first job out of college. I mean, I had no plans. And then on a whim, I was like, I'll join the Air Force. And then September 11th happened. And it wasn't until after that I got a true thirst for life and I guess enjoyment and appreciation. And I feel like, yeah, if you don't have that, and it's weird because you might not survive it. And that's obviously why it's a good thing that we don't have it.
Well, yes and no, right? And see, this gets back to the whole hunter-gatherer thing, and I don't want to get too deeply into this, but, you know, comfort and like how we raise kids. We're raising kids now trying to isolate them from every potential danger.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the end result of that? We've got kids who are lazy, entitled, unhappy, miserable fucks.
Yeah.
Because they've never had to overcome anything. And not only psychologically is that unhealthy, also physiologically it's unhealthy. I don't know if you're familiar with the hygiene hypothesis.
Mm-mm.
Which is that when we've eliminated so many of the sort of normal pathogens from our lives that, okay, our immune systems don't know how to behave because they never have to fight against anything.
That's right.
So then the immune system turns against the body and you get all these autoimmune disorders, all this asthma and, you know, and allergies and all this stuff. The theory is that it comes about because there's no challenge to the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
We need that. We evolve to be in this sort of conflictive dance with the environment where, you know, we're struggling against it. That's what makes us strong. You know, you think about, there's this really interesting idea in a book called Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb. He points out that it's a very simple idea, but very profound at the same time. If I say to you, imagine something fragile, you might imagine, let's say, a wine glass in a box, a wood box. If you shake the box, the glass shatters, right? So that's, mm-hmm, fragility. And if I say, imagine something anti-fragile, you might imagine a brick in the box. So you shake the box, nothing happens to the brick. That's the opposite. But in fact, it's not the opposite. The opposite would be something you put in the box, you shake the box, it gets stronger, right? The, mm-hmm, brick is neutral.
Right.
The brick is like a zero, right? And the wine glass is a negative 10. So what's a positive 10? What's something that gets stronger when it's challenged? Muscle, relationships, you know, you. Mm-hmm. You just talked about how you got stronger because of the challenges you faced in Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are anti-fragile. We're not stable. And yet we look at our lives trying to eliminate these challenges, thinking that that's going to make us stronger. It doesn't make us stronger. It makes us inert. It doesn't make our muscles stronger to not challenge them. It makes them flaccid,
yeah,
you know? And I think that we don't understand that properly. And because of that, we make ourselves miserable because we think that by eliminating the challenges, we're going to be better off. We think that comfort is a positive. Comfort isn't a positive. It's comfort is the brick.
Yeah.
It's not the thing. Like talking about when I was backpacking. So my favorite thing, some of my best memories are being in Alaska. It starts to rain. I find a little, you know, field somewhere, set up my tent, get in there. I've got my sleeping bag. I've got some nuts and wine and cheese and whatever, salami. It's fucking raining, miserable, cold outside within a foot of me. I'd be miserable, probably dying. But right here, I'm snug and cozy. I've got a glass of wine or drink from the bottle, of course. I've got some music. Ah, that is so much pleasure, right?
Yeah.
Compared to sitting in a 5-star hotel somewhere watching CNN. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
That's not pleasure. That's just the absence of displeasure.
That's right. That's right. I always, one of the most comfortable, I rode my bike across the country a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And one of the best feelings in the world is a nap after you've just rode your bike 75 miles in a cold rain.
Yeah.
It is, your body glows.
Or a shower.
Oh, it's fantastic. And there's actually, it feels good. You know that cold that gets down into your bones and you can't seem to warm up? That actually feels good, especially if you're in a hot bath, because it's just, because that first submersion, I don't even know, I'm terrible. Yeah. But anyways, as you get in the bath, that feeling of, it just doesn't go away. You have it for about 20 minutes and then the nap, and then it's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the thing. Our bodies evolved to be responding to these things, and we eliminate these challenges. We eliminate the movement. We eliminate everything. I have these friends who I stay with sometimes. They're wealthy and they're really nice people. And the woman last time I stayed there, she said, check out this new bed we got for the guest house. It's this $4,000 mattress, you know, see what you think. We really love it. And we got one for ourselves. So we got one for the guest house. So the next morning I go down for breakfast and she says, "So what'd you think of the mattress?" And I was like, wow, the mattress, let's see. I don't know. I took a shower. I went to bed and then I woke up. I guess it was good because I didn't notice it, you know?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, in terms of that anti-fragile thing, it's like, that's not comfort. That's just, I just felt nothing.
That's right.
You know? And so we arrange our lives to eliminate discomfort. You might say a 70-mile bike ride in the freezing rain is a fucking lot of discomfort.
Horrible.
We arrange our lives so we don't have to deal with that.
Yeah.
We've got the heated car. We're listening to our tunes. You know, the seat is heated. It's like cruise control. But then what did we experience, really?
Yeah.
Nothing. We were just numb. We were just not there. We just lost, you know, a day of our lives to nothing. It's like, what are we doing? It's weird. To me, it's all very strange, this eagerness to eliminate experience.
It's very Buddhist, which is why I was always turned off by the idea of the Buddhist religion, because their idea is to eliminate, you know, you've got is it the yin and the yang, or it's the...
Well, that's more Taoist.
Yeah.
But yeah, in Buddhism, you're trying to eliminate, you know, the clinging to things that you like and the aversion to things you don't like.
To get rid of anger, you get rid of happiness. To get rid of, you know what I mean? So there's no... And I never saw joy in that. I mean, well, because then you wouldn't have joy. You would have to get rid of it. You know, I like to feel... And I think most humans do. It's how it's obviously how we've evolved. But the pleasure in things is, you know, and you're right. The only way you can have it is to know the negative, I guess, aspects of it.
I struggled a lot with Buddhism over the years as well. And then I read something that really struck me. It was a guy named Trungpa, Choegyum Trungpa, was a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. And he talked about how in the West, there's this misunderstanding of the state of nirvana, which you're referring to there, as being sort of overcoming happiness and sadness and these things, and being in the state of sort of perfect bliss and not feeling those things. And the way he described it was, he said, for me, that's a misunderstanding. That it's not that you don't feel those things. In fact, it's sort of the opposite. It's that no matter how wonderful things are in your life at the moment, you never forget that that moment is is fleeting. They're not going to be wonderful forever. And that people around you are suffering incredibly. And no matter how terrible things get in your life, you never forget that they won't be terrible forever. And that there's incredible joy and beauty happening around you. So it's not that you don't feel them. It's that you always feel them in balance.
Okay.
You always feel both of them. So you look at a beautiful child and you think, this part of you is like, yeah, that kid's going to grow up and die. That kid's going to suffer. You acknowledge that, right?
Yeah.
But then you also see an old person dying in pain and you say, well, but that person's had a lot of joy in their life and there's a lot of, you know, so it's like you never lose the balance of perspective. And ever since I read that, I thought, yeah, okay, that, because that to me is kind of also, you mentioned turning 40, I'm 55, and, you know, something in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, like when you sort of finally grow up to whatever extent we have, that, you know, people say, well, how are you? And it's like, well, I used to be able to answer that. And now I just always feel like, yeah, you know, there's good stuff, there's bad stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of both. So how am I? I'm kind of always the same, I guess.
I equated turning 40, it's akin to sitting around a fire, I guess, in the ancient days. And I finally got the staff was handed to me, you know, I don't have to worry about being the warrior anymore. I now have a little bit of wisdom, I guess, and I can pass that on. So it's a comfortable position to be in, I think.
Yeah. There's something to be said for it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really know when it happened, but I turned, you know, I went from the adventurous young lunatic to the sort of mentor somehow.
Yeah.
You know, it all happened really quickly in my life because I wrote this book. I was, how old was I? I was like late 40s, I guess, mid 40s when I wrote the book. And yeah, so suddenly my whole life revolutionized, just everything flipped very quickly around that.
Yeah, the book was very successful.
Unexpectedly.
I guess as a psychologist, it's not like you expect to be thrust into the public eye. You know, it's not the profession that people pursue to wind up doing a TED talk or wind up, you know, having their own, a successful podcast or meeting Joe Rogan and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, I guess it speaks volumes for the talent, and you know, that you and your wife have and the, effort that you put into the book. So I highly recommend the listeners to check it out. You can find it on Amazon. That's where I found it. I had it read to me, via Audible, but, because that's, you know, we talked about to wrap it all up, I guess, to find all the room during the day. I mean, I don't read books. I have them read to me during my 20-minute commute to work and 20 minutes back. But you do that enough. I mean, enough books get in you. You know,
yeah.
There's no other way to do it. Or for right now, anyways, there's no other way for me to do it.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing it. It's, you know, probably half the people I talk to who have, quote, read the book did it through an audiobook.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's better than just sitting there, you know,
yeah,
listening to the same songs over and over again. Or
yeah, that's right. But yeah, I took a lot of your time here. And I know we had mentioned about a half hour, but I really appreciate it. Listeners can check out Tangential.
I know. It's hard. It's you know, I named my podcast something a lot of people can't say. That was pretty stupid.
I can't say a lot.
Tangentially speaking.
There we go. Tangentially speaking. I have an underlying dyslexia that I just kind of work through. It's like I used my own little tools to overcome it. But in medicine, it really messes me up because I come in and, you know, I try to tell someone, you know, a new medicine that they need to use or describe a disease state, and I'm screwing up words and they're like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah, right.
He can't say. Yeah. So,
well, I was on someone's show and they called my podcast Tangentially Speaking,
which, you know, I mean, you are, I think it's funny too, that, you've become the sex doctor. So not too far off.
Yeah. We talk about genitals sometimes. Yeah.
Did you ever think did you ever think you would be known as the sex doctor?
Oh, I don't know, man. I, I figured I'd be known as something.
Yeah.
It could go lots of different ways.
I mean,
my career is varied, as they say.
If someone Googles your name, 9 out of 10 things is going to mention something about sex, or the video will be about sex. Or, but you know, it's not, I mean, it definitely takes a different approach to it without giving away any spoilers there.
Yeah, I think when my next book comes out, that'll be, you know, some of the sexual stuff will be diminished.
Yeah.
Because the book's not about sex. So, yeah, the first book is largely about sex. And so that's, you know, reflected in a lot of things that people see and stuff that we talk about and all that. But, yeah, I mean, I never thought I would know so much about, you know, primate penises. That's not where I thought my career was going. But
it's funny.
I probably know more about, you know, primate penises and genitalia than I know more about dicks than most straight guys, that's for sure.
And in the medical world, I used to work in urology, and my friends and I would go out and get a beer, and they're all talking about work, and I'm like, all I have is penises and prostates to talk about, so
yeah,
I got nothing.
Well, I'm sure there's good material in there somewhere.
It's hidden. You gotta work for it, but all right, Dr. Ryan, I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
All right. You take care.
You too.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.